Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robinhood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Well, thanks, Marshall. Today, we're going to be talking about something that is certainly culturally related and theater related in the long run, but it's about a book. And if you took a poll of what was the most popular American novel of the 20th century, chances are To Kill a Mockingbird would come out on top. We all read it in school. It's been studied in college. It was a great American film. But why has it remained so popular? And the movie with Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch, so beloved. What role does it play in the popular and political culture? Those questions are entertainingly explored in a new book called Why to Kill a Mockingbird Matters. And my guest is its author, Tom Santapietro. Tom is the author of six other books about the classic films The Godfather and The Sound of Music, and four others about the lives of Frank Sinatra, Barbara Streisand, Doris Day, and singer Barbara Cook, and how they fit into the popular culture, too. So with all of that, welcome, Tom, to Off Script.
Oh, Dan, thanks very much for having me on the show.
My pleasure. So you took The Sound of Music, you took The Godfather, two famous blockbuster movies. You looked at why they became such fixtures in the pop culture, popular culture, writ large. Why did you turn to Kill a Mockingbird now?
I think that what I've realized about the books I've written is that I'm fascinated by these either novels or films that people don't just like, but basically become obsessed with and return to over and over again. And that they are these very American properties that have a worldwide following. So it's on those two levels that I'm most interested.
Right. So the book goes from biography of Harper Lee to the examination of how the book actually got published in New York, to the making of the movie, to what happened to all the personalities involved in all of that, and ultimately to the play that's coming up that we can talk about later. But let's go way back. Harper Lee is writing basically about her hometown, which takes a different name in the book. Let's get right to the question. How much of To Kill a Mockingbird is autobiographical?
A great deal of it is autobiographical, but of course, as any truly first-rate writer does, she takes those basics and then embroiders upon them and arrives at a completely different place that holds the essential truths of the autobiographical material. So the narrator of To Kill a Mockingbird, Scout, is a young tomboy in 1930s Alabama, and that's exactly what Harper Lee was. And Harper Lee's father, A.C. Lee, was a lawyer and a legislator, just the way Atticus Finch is. And, of course, the little boy next door, Dill, is based upon Harper Lee's famous neighbor, Truman Capote. And so you have those are the building blocks, but there are all the other elements that come into it. And what people forget is that Harper Lee herself said, "I'm Boo Radley." She really felt she was that misunderstood character, the reclusive, mysterious Boo Radley. So that's what I mean. You know, that's a whole other strand. Harper Lee is not just talking about herself as Scout, but also herself as Boo Radley.
Well, let's pick up that strand just for a minute and then get back to the guts of this. So basically, you've propositioned that the author, Harper Lee, is really an outsider. Does that give her an outside perspective on how she can go back and look at stuff that was really quite biographical and personal?
I think absolutely. That's a good question, because she was an outsider in many ways. And, you know, that's what writers do. They stand apart and they observe and they make their comments. And so she was standing apart, observing her own childhood, but observing it from the distance of nearly 30 years later.
Right.
And I think her standing as the outsider, and this really goes to the issue of why I think the book is still so important, is it gave her this understanding of what I call in my book the other. People who are different, who look different, who act different, who don't fit into whatever the norm is. And in Mockingbird, there are really two people who fit that. Boo Radley is one, and the other is Tom Robinson, who is accused, the African-American man who's accused of raping Mayella Ewell.
Right. I want to talk about the other and how the book relates to the civil rights movement in the 1960s later. But Harper Lee, that's not the name that she was really known by to people who knew her well. It was, and help me with the pronunciation of this, it was Nail.
That's a very Southern, very good pronunciation, right, spelled N-E-L-L-E. That would come out in a Southern accent, just as you said, as Nail. And then Harper Lee, so her full name was Nell Harper Lee, and her pen name was Harper Lee because she said she knew that people were going to mispronounce her first name as Nellie.
Ah.
And she really didn't want to be called Nellie, so that's how she became Harper Lee.
Got it. Okay. She wrote two books, and we're going to get to questions about that later, but she's really, for the most of her life, until just 2 years before her death, she was known for this one book, which arguably is a masterpiece. How did she get from her small town in Alabama to the big city of Manhattan and find this in the hands of the leading publisher in the United States?
Well, I think she, what I say in the book is that I felt she, Harper Lee, it was like she had to write her way out of her hometown, which was Monroeville, Alabama, disguised in the book as Macon. And I think she loved her hometown, that knowing everybody, but at the same time it was stultifying for her because everybody knows your business, of course. And because she was this tomboy, you know, she felt a little different. So she knew she wanted to write, and Manhattan, the center of self-reinvention in our country, was the place for her. So she went and took a series of, she was an airlines reservations clerk for a while. She took all these jobs to try to help support herself while she was writing. And finally, what the trigger was when friends of hers on Christmas Day said, go to the tree, and she went to the tree, and inside was an envelope that was a check with money and said, you are now free to write whatever you want for a year. And that gave her the time and the impetus to, for the manuscript to really take shape.
Now, which manuscript are you talking about? Are you talking about the manuscript that years later, just until a couple of years ago, became known as, was it Go Tell a Watchman?
Or Go Set a Watchman.
Go Set a Watchman. Or you're talking about the manuscript for To Kill a Mockingbird. Because she did take this, you write in your book about how she took this big hunk of manuscript and sent it back to one of her sisters in Alabama and said, just get rid of this for me. Or,
well, she didn't quite say get rid of it.
No, she said just take it. Take it away.
Well, here's how it happened. The manuscript she was writing was, in fact, Go Set a Watchman, and she delivered it in several chunks to her editor, a woman named Tay Hohoff, and who Harper Lee characterized very memorably as the Quaker Hitler.
Mm.
So she brought this to Tay Hohoff, and Tay Hohoff said, you have a voice, there's something here, but I'm most interested in the sections dealing with the childhood. At that point, you know, Go Set a Watchman, part set in the 30s, part set in the 50s when Scout has become an adult. And she said, concentrate on the childhood years. That's the story I'm most interested in. So then she went through three different drafts, and Go Set a Watchman became morphed into To Kill a Mockingbird. And Harper Lee herself called Go Set a Watchman the parent of Mockingbird.
Got it.
And so then, to speak to your interesting point about the manuscript and her sister, when it became To Kill a Mockingbird, which is, you know, quite a different book, she sent the manuscript back to her sister in Monroeville, who placed it in a safe deposit box in the bank, where it was not seen for the next 50 years.
Until it was discovered, until it was unearthed by the trustee of our estate, which you write about and then went on to be published separately just a couple of years ago. In case you're just joining us, the book, Why to Kill a Mockingbird Matters, my guest, Tom Santopietro, who's plumbing why To Kill a Mockingbird is so important to our pop culture. Let's skip ahead to the movie and the civil rights movement that was happening at the same time. The movie, directed by Robert Mulligan, with a screenplay by Horton Foote. To people who aren't familiar with theater and screenplay writing, Horton Foote, probably one of the best, best known for The Trip to Bountiful. Was there a better combination of director and screenplay writer that could adapt this? And how did they find their way to Harper Lee?
I think it was the ideal combination. It was just the right director with the correct writer. And so when Alan Pakula, the producer, and Bob Mulligan, the director, got the rights to the book, and they were not known well in Hollywood, but Harper Lee and her sister, who was an attorney and her advisor, granted the rights to them because they knew they would take such care of the book. And so when it was, they first asked Harper Lee to write the screenplay, a logical choice, and she said, I'm not interested in doing that. And everybody agreed that Horton Foote was the ideal choice because he made his whole career writing about small towns in the South. So he understood the story in his bones. He knew those dusty streets, and he and Harper Lee hit it off so well. And so it was kind of the perfect man combined with Robert Mulligan, who had a small but really terrific career, a director of real sensitivity. And they ended up with a film that I think is actually a masterpiece. I think it holds up beautifully.
Okay, let's go back to the book just for a minute. I had referred previously to the book as a masterpiece, but at the time there were some literary critics to this day who say, well, it's really not that good. Do you think the book's a masterpiece too?
I actually do, mm-hmm. And I don't throw that word around lightly. Mm-hmm. I think because there's so much cultural heft attached to Mockingbird now, that if you go back and you strip that away and you just read the novel for the beauty of the language and the story it's telling, which works on several levels, I really believe this is a masterpiece. And there's a reason why, nearly 60 years after publication, it still sells 750,000 copies every single year.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. Back to the movie. Atticus Finch. You can't think of Atticus Finch without that picture indelible in all of our heads of Gregory Peck with the horn-rimmed glasses, tortoiseshell glasses, and the white suit and the vest and the stopwatch. One of the astonishing things in terms of in the book that I found, and people who read Hollywood books and showbiz books love this kind of gossip, just spend a little bit telling us some of the other actors that were considered for this role, which I found just astonishing.
It is kind of fascinating when you go back and you see how these films evolve. And so the first person thought of to play Atticus Finch, it was actually came from Harper Lee. And she said, there's only one man I can see playing Atticus Finch, and that is Spencer Tracy. And when you think about it, he would have been good. He would have been a little old. But and so she wrote him a letter, and the answer came back, I'm making the movie Devil at 4 o'clock with Frank Sinatra. I can't even think about this. So it was kind of, the whole idea was dead in the water.
Yep.
And then Bing Crosby decided that he was interested in playing Atticus, but I don't think anybody liked that idea. Hmm. So that went by the wayside. And then the idea of Rock Hudson was floated.
That's the one that just floored me.
Yeah, because he was under contract to Universal, and Universal was going to distribute the movie. So, you know, they were trying to be practical and thought, well, here's our biggest star. We want him to play Atticus. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody knew that was not the right idea, at which point it was all of a sudden everybody thought, oh, well, this should be Gregory Peck, because he has the image, and that's who Gregory Peck was. And I go in my book, you know, to explain that the roles he had been playing were all kind of the proving ground for Atticus. He had played a backwoods farmer version of Atticus in the film of The Yearling, and he had played the crusading journalist in exposing anti-Semitism in Gentleman's Agreement. So, you know, Gregory Peck was not only like Atticus himself, but he gravitated towards those roles. So when he got the role, the great quotes were, Alan Pakula said, the actor and the role were very similar. And Gregory Peck himself said of getting the role, God smiled on me.
And tell us a little bit about not just Gregory Peck's relationship to the two kids in the movie, but how those kids were discovered. That's a remarkable story in itself.
Yeah, the kids were the really interesting thing to me about the kids was there was a nationwide search or a nationwide Southern search, and I interviewed that casting director for my book, and she went to seven or eight states and saw literal hundreds of kids, and she she said to Alan Pakula, Alan, because she was getting nowhere, you know, she was seeing little Shirley Temple wannabes, and she said to Alan Pakula, Alan, I just cannot talk to anybody under the age of 10 ever again. And so, and then, so she was kind of, you know, thinking, what am I going to do? And in walked Mary Badham. And instead of being a Shirley Temple wannabe, she looked like the picture of Scout. And so when Bodie, the casting agent, said to Mary, how old are you? And she said 9, but her Southern accent was so thick it came out as two syllables, 9.
Just like Nail, yeah.
Just like Nail, that's right. Exactly it. Yeah. And she said to Mary Badham, you look a little small for 9. And Mary Badham said, well, if you smoked as many corn silk cigarettes as I do, you'd be small too.
That's like a line out of the book from Scout.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And Bodie, the casting agent, told me she ran to the phone and she said to Alan Pakula, I think I found Scout.
Yeah, but her brother pops up from the same town, right?
Yeah, and Jem, played by Philip Alford, after these hundreds of interviews across seven states, Philip Alford lived 3 blocks from Mary Badham. They
wow.
didn't know each other. And she found the two kids on the same day in the same town, and they lived 3 blocks apart. That's a Hollywood story.
That is. And the story that we're talking about today is Why to Kill a Mockingbird Matters. It's written by Tom Sanciapietro, who's our guest today, and it plumbs the role that this famous book has in our pop culture. So let's get to that. The book was published in what year, 60?
1960.
1960, civil rights movement was really building up steam, came to a head in the mid-60s. Today you can't think of To Kill a Mockingbird without thinking about the racism that it explores, and the book is a part of American studies everywhere. And your book's really eloquent in dealing with that, and you talk about it, write about it a lot, but there's one phrase in the book that really, I think, struck me as what your book is all about in explaining why To Kill a Mockingbird matters. And you write that To Kill a Mockingbird is the piece of fiction that, quote, best explains America to itself. Could you expound on that, please?
Well, I wrote that because I think Mockingbird really does explain who we are as a country. And what it's saying is we have these high-flown ideals of liberty and justice for all, but look how we have treated our fellow Americans who we conceive of as the other. And so it's a very unique take on what I call our national original sin, which is racism as the legacy of slavery. So I think it's, and at the same time, I think it explains Americans, you know, our country to ourselves, because in the figure of Atticus Finch, she's created a figure that's the man we all want to be or want to think we can be, and that's whether we're men or women. He's this aspirational figure who always does the right thing. He's this kind of avatar of tolerance and justice. And so I think he gives us, in the figure of Atticus, to me, it's almost like he's the American ideal, and at the same time, she's saying, look how far we far short we fall of the ideal, but we still can be a better version of ourselves.
Right. And that notion resounds in the ending of To Kill a Mockingbird, where justice is really not very pure. Can you remind us about that?
Right. That's a great way of saying it. Justice is not very pure, because at the end of Mockingbird, when Boo Radley was thought of as the monster, saves Scout and Jem, but he does it by killing Bob Ewell. So he has committed murder.
And remind our readers who Bob Ewell was.
Bob Ewell is the he forced his daughter Mayella to accuse Tom Robinson of rape,
right,
which was a completely fabricated charge.
Right.
And so he really is the villain of the piece, you know, villain in quotes.
Right.
And so he attacks Jem and Scout on their way home at night, and it's Boo that saves the two children. And so it's another lesson there for Scout and Jem, or maybe their first lesson, I should say more properly, that good people do bad things, committing murder,
mm-hmm,
and yet for good reasons, which was to save their lives. So all of a sudden, the world is not black and white for these kids, but it's so many shades of gray,
mm-hmm,
and that's a universal lesson for all of us as we get older.
Given how facts don't seem to matter, given how news is fake, given how we default to black or white and run away from anything that requires an attention or an appreciation or understanding of the shades of gray in between, do you think To Kill a Mockingbird, either in book or movie form, is more relevant today, given how polarized the culture is and the politics too, than it even was in 1960?
I actually do. And for the reasons you just enumerated, because of what's going on in our country. And for me, the biggest example of that were the horrible events in Charlottesville a year ago, because you saw these white supremacists marching, you know, shouting these horrible racist, anti-Semitic, homophobic slogans, you know, after we fought a world war to defeat this sort of thinking. And so I looked at those people marching, and the iconography was oh so reminiscent of those Leni Riefenstahl films that she made for Hitler,
mm-hmm,
and particularly Triumph of the Will.
Mm-hmm.
And so then when the president, his response was, there are good people on both sides, I thought, you know, what universe are we in? Because that sort of thinking, you know, the Nazi sort of thinking is one of the few examples of it is black and white. There's no moral equivalency there. It's totally evil. And so circling back to Mockingbird, I had this very interesting reaction when I read and heard what President Trump said. I thought, oh, he's the anti-Atticus Finch, because Atticus Finch's biggest lesson is you never understand a person until you walk around in his skin. And I thought, well, Trump not only doesn't want to walk around in somebody else's skin, but he sees it as a sign of weakness.
Mm-hmm.
So on all those levels, that's an example of why the book matters to me so much.
Yeah. There's a little bit of an irony that we should briefly touch on in that going back to Go Set a Watchman, is that it?
Yes.
Correct. Atticus Finch is a different kind of person, just different kind of father in that book than he was in To Kill a Mockingbird.
A completely different person, and that's one of the... There were many reasons why the publication of Watchmen was so controversial, but that became the biggest flashpoint because he's revealed to be a racist in a lot of ways. And so that was upsetting everybody's picture of the ideal Atticus Finch. And my own reaction to that is that Watchmen is simply not as good a book as Mockingbird. It's not even close. It was unedited. It was presented as she had first written it. But I think the value of it is when it gives you this more rounded picture of Atticus when he's not as saintly, it just makes you think again about how complex and complicated every one of us is.
Right.
So ultimately, I even though I don't think it's a great book, Watchmen, I'm glad it was published.
Right.
One final question. In your other life, besides writing all these books, you also house manage Broadway shows, which you've done dozens of, including some of the big ones like Phantom of the Opera and Jersey Boys. So I want to ask you, upcoming in November, there's going to be, we've had the movie version, there's going to be a new play version of To Kill a Mockingbird, not based on the movie, but based on an entirely new dramatization by Alan Sorkin, who's, of course, won the Oscar for Social Network and all those Emmys for West Wing. What's your, being familiar with drama and theater, what's your expectation for this, and do you think this is good news for Harper Lee's legacy?
I'm really looking forward to seeing this, and I think what interests me the most, intrigues me the most, is he has a different take on the material, and I think we're going to see, from what I've read, we're going to see parts of the Atticus from Go Set a Watchman, who then, by the end of this play adaptation, morphs into the Atticus we all know and love. And I think Calpurnia, the African-American housekeeper for the Finches, is going to play a much bigger role in the play. So I like the fact that it's a new take on the material for the 21st century. And bottom line for me is, when the basic material is so strong, which Mockingbird is, it can stand up to all these different interpretations and still shine forth.
Well, thank you very much for all of that. And the book, Why to Kill a Mockingbird, matters or stands up to, I think, really careful scrutiny about why this book is so important. And as you so eloquently pointed out, Tom, why it should be reread now and why it's more relevant now. So I thank you again and again for being a guest on Off Script. And good luck with the book.
Thanks very much. And thank you for having me on the show. As a Connecticut native, I love the fact that I'm doing this interview on Connecticut radio.
Great. Thanks, Tom. And thank you all for listening. The show's been Off Script. My guest has been Tom Santapietro. He's author of the newly published book, Why to Kill a Mockingbird Matters. If you've enjoyed this show, please go to robinhoodradio.com. Go to the support tab and express your appreciation. We are listener supported. I appreciate that, as does Johnny Cake Books that underwrites this program. Until the next time, as a dear departed friend of mine used to say whenever I left his office, be well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.